Hey there, podcast listeners. I love using NovoPsych, which is why I'm really pleased for them to come on as a sponsor to our show. NovoPsych is the ultimate tool for administering psychological questionnaires, tracking outcomes, and informing treatment. With NovoPsych, you can easily access a wide range of evidence-based questionnaires and assessment tools. There's no more time-consuming scoring. It's all done very easily and automatically. There's over 100 psychometric tools available. NovoPsych has assessments for specific things like trauma, personality, and many other presenting issues that will really help a schema therapist understand complex presentations. What I really like is having all your client data securely stored in one place. It has really cool graphs and clear visualizations, which clients really like too. So if you're ready to enhance your practice, visit NovoPsych.com today and start your free trial.
Hi, you're listening to What's the Schemata, a schema therapy podcast for therapists. With ISST accredited schema therapy supervisors and trainers, Chris Hayes and Rob Brockman. For more information on schema therapy, visit our website, schematherapytraining.com.
Welcome, everybody, to What's the Schemata, the semi-monthly deep dive into all things related to schema therapy. Today, we have a very special guest, but before we get to that, g'day, Chris.
Hey, Rob, how are you? Good to see you.
Very, very well, thanks. You want to say a few things about our special guest today?
Yeah, look, we're here today with Georgie Pulick-White. She's an associate professor of clinical psychology and a research psychologist as well, and she's from the Perth Voices Clinic over here in Perth. Me and Georgie have been sort of imagery buddies for a little while, haven't we, Georgie?
Yeah, absolutely, Chris.
Imagery frenzies.
Yeah, we've been getting together like over probably the last 2 years. We've been getting together once every 6 weeks and having a few drinks and a bit of cheese and talking imagery. And when we got together, I don't remember you and me first, you know, when we got together to chat about this, you know, we just realized that there was such a bunch of people in Perth particularly that are really interested in imagery work.
Yeah, there's so many of us here. Honestly, it's quite a hub.
Yeah.
So I met you, Georgie, wasn't it last year? I was over in Perth doing a detached protector workshop and you came along and I guess we sort of geeked out over some lunch, and working with voices and problems related to psychosis is an issue that's very close to my heart as well. So that was really cool, and we started to think about how we might get together and do a pod. So here we are, and of course, only last month, it's been a whole month, we just got back from our yearly schema therapy retreat over in Bali, and so the geeking out continued for a little while. How are you feeling about all that, Georgie? Did you have a good time?
Yeah, fantastic. Bali was just such a great experience. Yeah, I think a highlight was the view from my balcony. No, just joking. Having Elsa and Remco over from the Netherlands was just so great. Yeah. And I came back just feeling so pumped. Don't you love that feeling when you go back to work after a holiday or a working holiday and just feel so invigorated?
Invigorated. You don't strike me as the kind of person that needs to be more pumped all the time.
Yes, often maybe calming down might be.
My favorite memory, because now that I'm talking to you, is watching you dance in a Bali pub.
Watching you dance, Rob, I think.
Well, that's your favorite memory. The night before your presentation, so that was really cool. Yeah.
We definitely had a lot of fun.
So why don't we get straight into it? And we'd like to start off these things off and to get to know a bit more about you guys. So why don't you say a few things about who are you, Georgie? Who are you? And how did you become that sort of voices lady?
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely am that voices lady. So look, it kind of dates back to when I was as young as 18, just starting out studying psychology. I got recommended a book just by a friend, by a lady called Anne Deverson, whose son had schizophrenia. It's called Tell Me I'm Still Here. And it was just incredibly moving. And the book just really struck me about how devastating psychosis can be for people that experience it and for their families. And in particular, being someone that was just starting out in psychology, realizing how much psychologists, even, you know, 20 odd years ago, really had no limited role working in that space, even at the time, 25 years ago, CBT was still recommended as a frontline treatment for psychosis clients. It really wasn't being seen in practice, especially not here in Australia. So I was really passionate, kind of did every single assignment on the topic and throughout uni, kind of led me into a PhD. And really by that stage, I got really interested in hearing voices and other hallucinatory experiences. And the main thing with that is it really touched me as a budding clinician, just how distressing and debilitating hearing voices can be, can really take over for people in their lives. But also from a research position, I was just really intrigued how the human mind can create such vivid and very real experiences that can really relate back to the person's prior life experiences. So that kind of got me down this track. Since then, I've kind of worked in psychosis services, but for the last 10 years, I've been running my own voices clinic just because this is, I guess, the hallucination space is more my passion. And really now, even though, Rob, you and I will geek out today about psychosis at different times, you know, it's not necessarily specifically my area as much anymore, because voices really are a really transdiagnostic experience in the sense that over 50%, about 65% of voice hearers out there actually don't meet criteria for psychotic illness. So just a reminder for our listeners that to meet criteria for psychosis, you do have to have two or more positive symptoms. So hearing voices itself isn't enough to be considered to have a psychotic illness. And then, so really a lot of our clients have a huge array of different presenting problems that I work with, personality disorders like cluster B, borderline or EUPD, what being one of the most common. But really what unites my clients, regardless of their diagnosis, is often the majority of them do have complex trauma histories. And that's absolutely backed by a huge amount of research that shows that over 80% of voice hearers do have childhood trauma, regardless of their diagnosis. And that, yeah, for a lot of them, unfortunately, it is prolonged childhood sexual abuse is the most common that we see. And that doesn't often happen in isolation. So often there may also be neglect, domestic violence in the family home. Also kind of that leads to often being heightened vulnerability of a school bullying or domestic violence in adulthood. So a lot of our clients do have a lot of trauma. I'm so sorry, you asked me about myself and I've totally just launched into
your work. I am my work.
Can I keep going for a few minutes? Is that okay?
Sure. Yeah. No, I think they'll be interested.
Because I guess I'm getting somewhere, which is really why you guys invited me here, which is, and why Chris and I know each other for quite some time, which is the imagery rescripting stuff, more recently into the schema world. But look, our clinic here, we really are, I started as a voices clinic 10 years ago, really knowing from having worked in this space for 10 years prior, just not so concentrated in voices, that of course I was going to be working with traumatized individuals, but I didn't quite realize how much I was actually running a trauma clinic. And really early, the first year that we started running the clinic 10 years ago, I was really lucky. I was at an APS conference in Adelaide and Arnold Arntz was there presenting a workshop on imagery scripting. It was why I'd gone, so I knew a bit about it, had done some imagery work in my work, but not specifically schema style of imagery scripting, more Emily Holmes style. So I targeted that conference to meet Arnold, and he and I spoke there, and he was actually really keen already to do some voices work. It had been something he'd identified before going there as an area much needed. So he and I struck up a collaboration there. And within the next year or so, we'd started our first case series. I was so lucky to have had a lot of clinical supervision by Arnold as part of these research projects over the years. And that led into an open trial of imagery rescripting. We can talk more about that in a minute, I'm sure. But yeah, got off the topic, but that's really me as where I came from and the work I'm doing now. Both, and I really see myself as a scientist practitioner doing, you know, all the work I see, seeing my clients clinically feeds back into the research side of me of wait, you know, how does that might work this way, or maybe we can improve this type of intervention that way. So yeah, I really truly see myself as a scientist practitioner, and I love that.
Yeah. And like, to some degree it sounds, and I don't mind this as a clinician, there's a sense of kind of working it out as you go.
Yeah.
So you're at a trauma thing with Anud, learning about imagery scripting, but you're seeing these clients with voices who have a lot of trauma, and then you're sort of thinking, well, why aren't we doing this?
Yes.
What I really took from the training and just being speaking with you over the years is, particularly recently, I think particularly straight after this recent trip to Bali, was just to ask the question more. And to be honest with you, suddenly I have a new, you know, sort of experience of a couple of clients of, you know, they're sort of talking a bit about it because I've asked the question. So it's interesting in that sense of, you often don't think to ask about voices and this sort of stuff, how it can map onto modes and trauma and about, you know, difficult, adverse childhood events.
And there is such, I mean, you mentioned what a tragedy it can be for families, you know, when a loved one might, not just voices, I guess, but if they developed a full-blown psychotic illness and those kind of things can really get in the way of life and change things, you know, and have big impacts. But how much stigma has always affected the field? And, you know, if you had a child who had cancer or Alzheimer's or some early onset or something, there'd be this kind of community thing and we're all rallying around the family. But for a lot of folks that go through this and families that go through this, it's sort of something that's not addressed in the same way due to the stigma, I guess.
So right. And, you know, it is that the stigma that holds people back, not even just from sharing it with their family and friends, which absolutely does stop people from sharing, but also even with psychologists. So absolutely, I've definitely seen multiple clients, well, many, many clients, in fact, who have said to me that they've seen some psychologists in the past and some great psychologists and still done some really great therapy, but they've actually managed to not disclose this because they worry that they'll be seen as being unusual or psychotic when they don't indeed have a psychotic illness, and worried they might be referred on, which does happen a lot. And I do get that, especially if someone does come specifically wanting to work on voices and you've got no training in it, that makes sense. But unfortunately, sometimes clients do just come to work on their trauma or work on anxiety disorders, and yet they might get referred on because the clinician does kind of go, hearing voices, that's frightening.
So again, there's that stigma even amongst clinicians, either to not ask the question for fear,
be terrified
of,
if they
fear
do
of upsetting the client or something, you know, or maybe sometimes overreacting, you know, and not being able to sit in that space and explore the experience and sort of, you know, I've had experiences where people say, look, you know, I mentioned this thing and all of a sudden, you know, I had nurses rocking up to my house and, you know, they took me off to, you know, up to the inpatient ward and things, you know, so yeah, the stigma affects everything. Yeah.
Absolutely. And just coming back to Chris, your point about asking about it more commonly. And I think part of what might have raised your awareness, yes, was about how transdiagnostic this is and how linked to trauma, but also the stats on voice hearing that we haven't covered here, but did in the workshop. You know, mass population studies have been done that show that as many as 10 to 25% of the population will hear voices at some stage in their life. And we're not just talking, these studies really screened out when people were having a fever or drug induced or sleep deprived. And we're not just talking having your name called or hearing things as you're falling or waking out of sleep. So it is actually a really common human experience. And I'm often having people and telling me at social situations when I might have mentioned that I work in this space, people coming up to me later and saying, hey, I'm actually a voice hearer. So really just seeing that. Yeah.
There's a long history, isn't there, guys, of like, so the stigma makes sense as much as it's not useful these days, but you can imagine, I don't know, 100 years ago, if you mentioned this to someone in town or in the village or something, what might happen, you know, in terms of the stigma that you might attract?
Well, maybe mention it 500 years ago and maybe you would have been seen as like this amazing shaman, you know, having magical abilities that were actually really appreciated and valued. And there's been lots of studies that show that actually when you are in a culture that does value these experiences and make sense of them in a positive way, how much less distressing they are.
They do a lot better, of course.
How much less impact they have on people's lives. So, but we're getting off topic. Let's bring it back.
So one of the intersects, okay, so I guess the scheme of therapy, and we're trying to find the intersection between the two. Okay, so one of the main intersects is through imagery with scripting work. So I'd be interested, you know, and the audience would be interested to hear about if there's any modifications between the traditional sort of Arnold Arntz approach to imagery scripting. You know, you've obviously had this recent research trial looking at imagery scripting for voice hearers. Can you tell us a little more about how these two connect?
Thanks, Chris. And yeah, look, anyone that wants to get in touch or look it up, yeah, we've got one case series that was published in 2019, but we've just had accepted our open trial of 50 participants, transdiagnostic. So we learned a lot from that. But absolutely, let's stay really clinical, because you are right, Chris, we did modify imagery scripting, and I just want to be clear that we did do it as a standalone imagery scripting trial. It is schema style of imagery scripting that we're talking about, but it was done specifically to treat trauma in trauma-affected voice hearers, hoping that we would also see, so firstly, expecting to see reduction in PTSD symptoms like nightmares and flashbacks, but also in voice frequency and severity and distress in particular. And we got some really lovely outcomes in all of those outcome measures, just to kind of beat you to the punchline. But in terms of what we changed, so firstly, it was a big bit about formulation, about understanding the association between people's voices and the content of people's voices and their trauma. So understanding, so a lot of our clients will either hear a direct association, so they might actually hear the voice of their abuser. They might hear the voice sounds exactly like the abuser saying the same things they said in the abuse. Sometimes it might even be multisensory, so they might feel their breath on their neck or something like this, which obviously, as you can imagine, would really heighten distress. It's almost akin to a PTSD flashback, but it's not so multisensory. When people are having a flashback, they get taken back to that moment in time. They'll often see the full room they're in around them. But this is specifically just the voice. It's very auditory. But then there's an indirect association where people are hearing, really in terms of schema terms, it's just a link to the schemas that were developed. So if people have internalized their trauma, which a lot of our clients have, and they have a kind of a defectiveness shame schema, voices will really just tell them that they're worthless, they're useless, pathetic, you know, they're not as good as others. They'll call them maybe the same similar words that bullies might have still called them in back at school, but they're not the same. They can't identify.
What kind of link would you get? I mean, I guess in terms of obviously the hearing experience is occurring now. Like, how can you maybe tell the audience a little bit how you go from current voice hearing to the re-scripting? Is there anything different in that?
So really just that kind of during formulation is exploring those links. And then in terms of when we're choosing the memories, so that kind of early phase of imagery where you might be starting to look at what different clusters of trauma do we need to be targeting and what are some of the standout memories within each of those clusters. I talk about clusters because, like I said, most of our clients don't just have one type of trauma, repeat trauma. They'll have multiple clusters like sexual abuse, also bullying, also some childhood domestic violence. So, but in that, when we're selecting which memories, we do like to pick ones that are really related to the voices.
Yep.
So again, that's something that's specific to our trial that wasn't in a lot of, so there's been some prolonged exposure and EMDR studies that although they have found that, yes, it's safe to do this work in psychosis, yes, people don't, some PTSD reductions are found. They didn't find that there was any reductions on voice severity or distress, whereas we did. And we think one of the reasons for that is that we were really targeting specific memories. So if a voice was saying to them, you know, you stupid, stupid girl, And they've got these clear memories of mum saying, "You stupid, stupid little girl." That would be any that we'll target those specific if we were working on their relationship with mum and the abuse they got from her.
So that would be a very obvious target for you.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah,
when you see those.
And would you use it as a float back, or would it be more like you would use this sort of affective float back idea, or would it be more just, okay, let's link up some memories that might be linked to that kind of, you know, vocal attitude that's coming from your voice? That's a, I don't know.
No, you're right. So sometimes it's just really obvious and we don't need to do that affect bridge. Yeah. We kind of know there's, you know, I just ask the client, you know, this particular saying the voice says is really upsetting for you. Like, does a memory just come to mind that you can see that link? And sometimes it is really clear for client. Sometimes it's not, but this particular saying or phrase for the voice is really triggering for a client, really repetitive for the voice. So we'll do an affect bridge where we'll get them to close their eyes, go back to a recent time where they were at home, their voice started saying, "You stupid, stupid little girl." We'll get them to connect that memory with their eyes closed or experience that, and then allow that image to fade to the background, and, as you know, kind of allow a childhood memory to kind of crop up. Mm. And usually that indeed will be a related memory. So we do that, but only really when we need to. Yeah,
sure. Well, so many questions for you, Georgie. Like, the first thing that pops into my mind as you talk, I wonder how much of this, the positive processing that happens, can be a little bit metacognitive, in the sense that, you know, what you're doing, you're going with this voice and you're linking it to the past, and what they might take out of that is, you know, my voice is really related to mum. It really does sound like what I went
through,
you know, and that's not something they'd usually sort of link together, and you're making it really salient and experiential. It's a metacognitive thing.
People really, and we published a qualitative study from the open trial. We actually got a lot of feedback, and that was a really big thing, was people's understanding of their voices really improved, even though it wasn't an explicit aim, just through this work, both through formulation, but actually, like you say, through the experiential work itself, really understanding these links. And some of our clients even came in believing, well, there's no link, Georgie, because I've got these are my more psychosis-based clients, they might say, because it's actually a chip in my head. The voice is,
or it's the aliens or whatever it might be.
The aliens. But they could still say, you know what, Georgie, I do have childhood trauma. I know it affects me. Maybe the aliens or the chip do feed in and off of this childhood trauma, because I can understand that link. And then even though we've done no kind of cognitive, I guess, reappraisal of that belief around the voice and its origin, by the end of imagery scripting, a lot of clients had just come to their own conclusion. There was no real light bulb moment, but they really had shifted actually in the belief and understanding because of this experiential work, because they could see, well, when we process that trauma of mum, well, that memory of mum saying, "You stupid, stupid little girl," my voice has actually stopped saying that. They start to kind of really understand that maybe they really are trauma caused or influenced voices.
So, of course, almost no clients.
It's like there's like a personification of some of the modes in schema modes.
We're getting there.
I'm just interested in this because, like, obviously, you've been talking about like a punitive kind of, you know, experience of being punished. You're dirty, you know, dirty, naughty little girl kind of thing. Typically, it sounds like the imagery of scripting would be quite typical, standing up against the antagonist. How would it work in terms of, you know, other modes, like more coping modes? Do you ever get sort of voice hearing coming about that way? And would the imagery be different?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'm going to, by the way, I've got two more points I want to make about imagery, so I'll go back there.
Yeah.
But the mode bit, we've done a recent study. One of my great master's students, I want to make sure I say his last name correctly, Asher Matushevich.
You're just trying to remember his name, aren't you?
No, I'm just so dyslexic that he's saying people's last names.
I'm only joking.
It's tricky for me.
I'm only joking.
But anyway, we've done this great poll study that really did try and map on voices to modes, because this is really how we've got from imagery through to now doing schema-related work, is understanding, do voices map on to key modes? And we didn't find evidence of coping modes voices often elicited coping modes within the client, but the voice themselves were not coping modes. They were mostly inner critic voices. A few voices would be more representative of a vulnerable child voice that would purely be very scared, childlike, crying, screaming, and also having occasionally voices. Clients will actually hear very positive voices, ones that guide them, can calm them, and they tend to be more of a healthy adult voice. So there are others other than the inner critic. Let's come back to that. Can I still mention, just back to, if there's people in the audience that are going to do some imagery scripting with voice hearers, I feel like there's still two more things I want to say quickly, just because, just to make sure clinically people are doing some of the key things that we found helpful. Is that okay?
Of course, yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. So I guess one of the things we did do, so in terms of like, we think all the way back to kind of that Arntz and Workman paper 1999 that kind of talked about the three phases of imagery. So phase one, therapist enters the image and kind of leads the rescript. Phase two being healthy adult enters the image. Phase three being you repeat that from the perspective of the child seeing the healthy adult rescript. So we found that when we moved on after the first kind of six or so rescripts from phase one, where I would enter the image, help get the child's needs met in the image.
Yeah.
Actually, clients were dissociating, especially our psychosis clients. Because our clients have such complex and repeat childhood trauma, again, the majority of clients I'm talking about here, is that their healthy adult is not very intact. And so, especially without doing broader schema work where you're actually explicitly working on developing the healthy adult, even with me modeling it for a good kind of six sessions, it still wasn't sufficient. And when we had their healthy adult enter, even if I entered to kind of, I guess, champion and support them, we did find that they were dissociating more. They were sometimes jumping perspective. We even had some clients that would jump into the perspective of the abuser, and then into the vulnerable child, and then in back into healthy adult, and then sometimes even into a bystander. It really wasn't going all that well. So we decided as a group, I should just plug here, Craig Steele was also part with Arnold and I doing this work. We decided as a group, to keep it just a phase one, just therapist entering the image. Mm-hmm. I do want to say, though, now that I'm a schema therapist and do this work where we have been doing more building the healthy adult in chair work and other ways. Actually, towards the end of schema, we absolutely have been doing phase two, three successfully with these clients and finding it adds a huge deal to the rescripting process. But when you're doing fairly short term, because one thing I didn't mention is our first case series was only 10 sessions, including the assessment and the wrap-up session. And yet we still got great outcomes. So we really were diving headfirst into this trauma work. The second was somewhere between 10 and 20 sessions, but we really were getting great outcomes quickly. But it does mean that this is quick and fast.
You can't skip the phases. You can't. So what you really got out of that is that 10 sessions, whilst you can get some good outcomes, it's not really enough. Like for all the schemas and all the work.
Yes, exactly. It was great for PTSD. We even saw some good reductions in voices, but people's healthy adults were still in development. We were still seeing difficulties regulating affect. Yeah. Chris, I can see.
So just to, I was going to say just because I think there's some, obviously some of the way that people train people in different imagery. I just want to let the audience know. So it's phase one is therapists going in and rescripting. Phase two is the client as an adult now going in and rescripting the little child. And phase three is the client being the child experiencing the adult rescripting. So just to let you know, because I think
I said that very fast.
Can I just say also?
No, and also there's European discussion, the European sort of
phases,
and then there's everyone else. And I think I've seen a couple of supervisors going, "Oh, what's phase three?
Phase three. Look, can I just say too? It's a reminder that how amazing it was what you've managed to do, Georgie, working with these folks in a 10-session Medicare model. So most of this research was done with 10 sessions under Medicare.
Yes, correct. Right?
Medicare in Australia, you get sort of potentially access to 10 sessions per year. And then when you mentioned for some 20, this is during COVID when they gave you an extra 10 sessions.
Yes.
So I'm just very impressed that you're able to do this on the front line with Medicare. Like this is something that can be done.
And it was great because, you know, we had the IRM study that I'm not even sure was, I mean, it wasn't published when we started our first case series, but you guys had, Chris, you were involved in that, had the data from the IRM study, which was comparing EMDR and imagery rescripting for clients with repeat childhood sexual abuse. And we knew that we didn't need a stabilization phase. It could be short. People were diving on in there and having great outcomes. Very limited, if any, kind of more adverse outcomes. So we were really reassured by that. And again, obviously, Arnold was part of that trial, and as he was, the voices. So we felt confident. And I'm so glad we were, because I'm glad we didn't use so many sessions trying to get stabilization. Our clients, by the way, though, at our clinic, do have to be relatively stable. So if they do have a psychotic illness, it's actually not the best time for one-on-one therapy. It doesn't mean there's nothing you can do, but certainly doing deeper work like schema or imagery or any trauma-focused work when someone's in acute phase of psychosis, that's just not the right timing. Yeah.
So you weren't excluding people for having so-called psychotic illness.
No,
you were excluding people who are floridly psychotic.
Floridly psychotic. Yeah, and that's just more broadly good clinical practice in terms of they're just not going to get the most out of therapy at that time. They are, better off.
So you're able to work with people that were relatively stable.
Yeah. Especially when you only get 10 Medicare funded sessions, it's better to use them when people are actually able to do the work. And I know I can see you want to jump in with one more question, another question, but just to my last thing on imagery rescripting, the modifications. Look, we've tried to make all of our papers to be published in journals that are clinical and kind of open access, which means clinicians that might not be linked to a university can openly access these. So we did publish a study in 2020 on how to do modifications specifically to reduce dissociation. And this is in voice hearers, but I think these skills can actually work with some of our clients have DID or dissociative identity disorder as well. But again, voice hearing even itself is a dissociative experience. And so most, if not all of our clients to some degree do dissociate, whether it's more just attachment or if it's through to kind of, you know, really being so detached, they kind of, I guess, are absent or lose time or have a voice take over in the case of DID. So we've got a paper there. I'm not going to go through all the ways that we modify things to reduce dissociation, but that paper is
just a little bit. Come on, tell us something.
Give us one thing. What's one thing?
Is there anything that
your go-to thing?
Yeah, one or two things.
I guess probably they might keep. Point would just be it's better off to avoid dissociation than it is to kind of stop it once it's started.
Yes.
So there's lots of things we can do to reduce things like making sure the client starts the rescript calm enough. So you might need to do a few minutes of slow breathing just to bring, if you've already talked about the trauma and that's brought their affect level up, doing a few minutes of slow breathing or whatever tool you've got with your client just to bring them down before you commence. Also, you might need to enter the image or start the rescript earlier. So you might actually need to be keeping your eyes on the client, making sure you can read their body language. You might need to step in earlier than you thought you would because the client's affect's going up. We know that dissociation's triggered when affect gets too high. So it's about doing things and moving very relatively quickly through the original memory. So not spending, so sometimes it's only 30 seconds to a minute, a couple of minutes max that I would be in the original memory before we commence the rescript because the client's affect is just building and building and building throughout that. The other thing is to talk about the first few steps of the rescript before you've gone in. And this is what's quite different to the way I rescript than a lot of others wouldn't, is that I will talk through with the client about whether or not, for instance, if it's a capital T trauma, whether I would enter with police and what would happen, that the police would arrest
the person. There's no surprises. There's a level of control and expectancy.
If they know I'm going to come and de-shame them, and then I will then go and tell off the perpetrator before they're taken away by the police. If they know those steps, they don't come as a surprise. They don't feel overwhelmed by them. Yeah. So I don't tell them all the way through to the end. And of course, by the end, I'm not necessarily leading the rescript either. By that stage, I'm asking them, what else do you need? Allowing them to take a lot more control over their way of soothing and what else they need from perhaps parents or others in the rescript. But certainly the first few points we do talk about and agree to before we commence. Yeah.
So the strategies are you're not teaching them extensive skills like to tolerate the work, but rather you're adapting your style to be more containing of the work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So get it on the window.
Yeah. And then there's lots of little, you know, trick bits. I often hold one end of a scarf with the client just to kind of keep them grounded. If I think they're starting to not answer me when I ask them a question, then I will give that a little tug just to make sure. And sometimes if they have started dissociating, just that little tug with my words of, just a reminder that you're safe here with me in my office. You don't need to dissociate. Those words and that little tug is enough at that early phase of dissociation just to bring them back. And usually you can continue with the rescript as you are. Yeah.
So also what you're saying though is we don't want the client to dissociate. Prevention is better than cure. If I'm reading this right though, it's also inevitable if you work in this space enough, there are going to be times when your client...
Oh, absolutely. And that's why I've got a grab bag of skills, everything from sensory items through to that scarf.
No. So we're not avoiding the work.
We're not avoiding it. But I mean, yes, we do.
Now, we're going to move on in a sec. But again, one little thing we have to be really clear about the outcomes. All right. So you've run a single case series and now you've run an open trial, okay, of 50. So we've gone up to 50 participants. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
And so we've managed to get good outcomes on voice distress and voice severity.
Yeah.
So that voice severity in particular is like a golden chalice in this area.
Yeah, I know.
Like I think almost no studies show, right, changes to the voice experience itself. Yeah.
So like often you do expect if distress reduces, frequency would reduce because they work in a cycle. The more distressed people are, the more that triggers the voice, the more the voice speaks, the more distressed the client is. So if you're reducing the distress around the voice, it reverses that cycle. So you might expect it to some degree. We've had some success in some of our other interventions at our service and in previous interventions that I've helped to deliver before that or develop. But it is cool. It's great.
Mm. And the other thing is, and we have to establish also if it's safe. All right, because what I've always had working in this field, especially with colleagues in other disciplines, especially those that might be coming from a medical background, is a reluctance to really to do anything experiential with folks that might have psychotic symptoms.
Absolutely.
So, and I've asked you, I know what you're going to say, but I want everyone to hear this. You know, did your intervention make people more psychotic? Can it be done safely? What did you find?
I said, absolutely. No.
Absolutely. Everyone is psychotic.
No, that's not my answer. It's a great question because you're right. There's so much hesitancy in this field. Clinicians are often saying, no, I would never do that with a psychosis client. What if they became psychotic? Look, we absolutely didn't find any relapse in psychosis in either the case series or the open trial or in any of the schema work we've been doing since. And that was actually the same with the EMDR, not that we've done it, but other groups have done in the UK and the Netherlands is they've done some EMDR, they've done some prolonged exposure. And while they didn't have as good effect sizes as some of these imagery scripting outcomes, They were, however, still finding it to be safe. There was no, you know, relapses of psychosis that appeared to be related. I mean, in larger trials, you will have people naturally fluctuating. So occasionally there might be a relapse, but that was often clearly linked to other events happening in people's lives. But we just didn't find any of it. So thanks for raising that. Yeah. Good thinking.
So in terms of linking this in with schema therapy practice side of things, are there any particular schemas and modes you think that might be most common in voice here?
Yeah, absolutely. So great question, Chris.
It's like we develop these questions.
We've
spoken about this.
All right. So look.
Here comes an essay from Georgie.
This is great. This is awesome. So absolutely. So there hasn't actually been a great deal of research in the schema therapy space and voices. So this is something that, like I said, Arnold's been really excited by. He and some colleagues have done some work in DID, a case series that's been underway. But other than that, not. So he's for a long time been saying to me, he and I have been talking about how voices really do appear to be related to modes, they themselves. So that relates back to that discussion we had before a little while ago, that voices themselves seem to be the most dominant voices, seem to be inner critic style voices, criticizing the same way that the client's own modes would. So the voice is telling them they're not good enough, you're going to fail at that, you know, or just really demanding, telling them you must do this, you must do that. The voices tend to replicate or personify modes. But you are right, the clients, of course, have their own modes as well and their own schemas. And although there's limited research, we've been doing both qualitative research, that some of which is already in publication, and we're doing some more cross-sectional, larger numbers, but via questionnaires like the schema mode and young schema questionnaire to large numbers of transdiagnostic voice hearers. And they are those preliminary outcomes are kind of supporting what we're seeing in our therapy clinics. Not surprising, based on the kind of childhood type of traumas our clients go through, there's lots of internalization that happens for voice hearers through trauma. So in terms of schemas, we're seeing a lot of those kind of defectiveness, shame schema, sometimes the social isolation, alienation, like I just don't belong in kind of with my peers and with my, even in my family context, I didn't feel like I belonged. Mm. Lots of rejection there. That rejection can also come up in things, you know, abandonment. Sorry, that word just my mind, abandonment schema. But of course, the more externalization ones are things like a really strong mistrust abuse schema in a lot of my clients, which makes it difficult to form new and trusting relationships.
Yeah.
And when I get to modes, will make sense as well. And also emotion deprivation. A lot of our clients had all three growing up, in the sense of not being protected, not being emotionally validated, and not being nurtured the way they needed to. So that's also a really strong schema that comes up in
our life. So you've been talking about trauma and abuse and thinking about people with these kind of profiles as having, you know, being trauma cases, basically. Yeah. But also you make the argument now, I think, that a lot of this is about attachment.
Mm, absolutely.
You know, so it's attachment-based, it's trauma-based. And, of course, schema therapy is a good candidate for that. We've been working with, you know, personality disorders and other attachment type disorders for a long time now. So there's a synergy there. It makes sense.
Absolutely. And it's such an overlap. You know, of course, schema developed for borderline personality disorder clients. And, you know, so many of our clients, even if they don't meet criteria for that, do have overlapping kind of characteristics. So difficult to learn how to regulate when your childhood is full of adverse, difficult life experiences. And like you say, attachment-based traumas as well, that lack of protection and validation and even just nurturance. It's huge. And that kind of, in terms of the modes, just because I know we'll probably move on in a sec, our clients tend to have a very low healthy adult. So again, it wasn't modeled for them often very clearly from sometimes there's not even a single parent that is able to kind of pull that or give them that.
I was having a little chuckle to myself earlier when you were saying, well, you know, we did 10 sessions where I was modeling the healthy adult. And I was like, okay, so they've got 10 hours of that versus 30 years.
Whole life, right?
44 decades of no healthy adult and violence.
It's not going to be enough. And that's why we've branched into schema, right? Is because it isn't enough. And we need to do more explicit work with this, as well as the limited reparenting that happens in the therapy, but also within the imagery scripting.
It's going to take a bit.
So our clients have these they come in with often very low levels of healthy adult, high internal inner critic. Sometimes that is almost masked by the dominant voice who takes over and just is the inner critic, and the client's own inner critic is almost suppressed because the voice is doing it for them, but often not. Often the client's own inner critic is also very much present and accounted for. So there's their own thoughts of I'm not good enough or I need to do better. Lots of guilt-inducing inner critic as well. A lot of my clients may have also had younger siblings they had to look after. So they've got that over sense of self, like responsibility to look after siblings or a parent. So in terms of, you know, self-sacrifice and subjugation are often a big part of their schemas as well. So we have that kind of guilt-inducing inner critic to be quite strong. And then in terms of voices, often a really key example is the voices will be very sometimes the style of voice, and we still are trying to theorize whether it's a form of the inner critic, like a parental mode or something else. We have a lot of times where voices are telling them you can't trust people, or even one step further, that person's going to abuse you, or if you go today, you're going to be assaulted. Yeah. And what we do know really clearly is what it activates within the client. And that's their coping modes. And their coping modes are often very avoidant-based. So detachment, detached self-soother, or just avoidance of relationships and going out, or the over-control.
Suspicious over-controller. So there is, I know you said that in the qualitative research, it wasn't really about the coping modes and voices, but there is, I mean, when you think about paranoia and the function that could play, it does seem that there may be some room for that yet.
Absolutely. And it's more just the content of the voice. I think it's just as important both what mode the voice itself represents, but also what mode it's triggering in the client, because that's its function. So these voices that are saying things like you can't trust that person or that person's going to hurt you, it's about the fact that within the client it triggers the vulnerable child to feel scared, and then triggers the coping mode of either avoidance or being overly suspicious and guarded. And that's what the function of the voice, right? It's triggering protectiveness. So the client's putting up this protective barrier so that they won't get hurt.
If we work through it, like a fairly common mode map, we'd have a vulnerable child.
Yep.
Yeah, plus, plus.
Plus, plus.
There might be some angry child in there. There might not. What do you think? Do you get much angry child?
Yeah, look, it really varies. So a lot of, like, I feel like for my clients, it's either not present at all. It's an emotion that's been very, really not been okay. It's been very scary in others. But if they show it in their family, it's been really
dangerous, I imagine.
Dangerous, yes. So my clients either have no angry child, not enough, almost you need to kind of almost foster hearing the presence of the angry child to understand those needs that it might represent. But then other clients are the other way around. Anger is safer.
They're dysregulated in their
anger. Yeah, if feeling dysregulated in the form of being overly sad or scared feels much more vulnerable than feeling angry about things. So we kind of get more clients than not, I would say, a voice here as our internalizers. So they do tend to not have a strong angry child present, but then those that do have it quite strong.
So there's that inner core of certainly vulnerability, maybe some anger. Then you've got, I think if I'm hearing you right, you're talking about like a super critic.
Yeah.
So these folks have very intense inner critics with different themes, punitive themes, oftentimes guilt themes. Now, something that I really loved about your conceptualization is that you drop the mode map like this, and then if there was a predominant voice experience attached to that mode, you've got this little audible icon that you'd put on top of the moat. So it's like, well, they have that moat, they have their own inner critic, but on top of that, sometimes it's audible and they'll hear it as like a critic or their abuser. Okay.
And of course it doesn't sound like that. And that's why there's so much to learn, I think, about actually the schema model from working with voice hearers, about the actual schema model, because you are almost working with where it came from. So again, often the client will be hearing their mother. So when you say it's, you know, it's a punitive parent, it legitimately
it literally is
your parent. It literally
even sounds like
penalization of that parent. So there's it's the model, but even more directly.
And then coping modes, of course, you've mentioned things like avoid and protect, maybe some sort of over-controller type mode, suspicious over-controller, being really careful, self-soothing. Of course, we know a lot of drug and alcohol type problems in that population. So this really is just a mode map of sort.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, with some voice, some very intense voice hearing on top.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you want me to tell you a few more things about how we we modify schema work? Like, we've talked more about the theory and the, I guess, the schema.
Well, I was thinking about chair work. Like, maybe we could talk a bit about, because it sounds like, okay, you've been doing the imagery work, targeting the trauma memories, but now you've expanded to like the whole map. The first thing I want to ask you is, how do they respond to that? How do these folks respond to like a mode map when you put that to them?
Yeah, great. Look,
In general, I know some people probably don't like it, but
No, look, I mean, generally for most of my clients, you know, a lot of my clients, they have traditionally, if they've spoken about their voices with people, it's ended up them being in psychiatry. And often the questions are just, do your voices tell you to hurt yourself or others? These really kind of risk-based questions. No one's really listening. And no one, their experience has often been, they don't get asked a great deal about, not, you know, something that Eleanor Longden, who's a bit quite famous voice hearer and psychologist, wonderful TED talk, look it up. But one thing that, a quote that I often say is, the question to ask is not, you know, what's wrong with you, but what's happened to you. And I think schema is so validating because it really explores these people's life history and helps them make sense of not just their voices in that context, but also why they've been so dysregulated in their emotions, how that's played out in their social relationships, because there's been a lot of havoc in lots of spaces in their life. So actually the psychoed, bringing it together in the formulation, is great. I try and get chairs in the room, even if I'm not sitting, getting clients to sit in them or anything, even at the point of formulation, because the parts work part of schema is what I think works so nicely for voice hearers. They already have parts, they're called voices, but then of course they do have their own parts. They've got their own modes, and actually separating them out as well, like for all of our clients, it really just helps them so much to see them, understand them, and not feel overwhelmed by them. So I often will get clients chairs out, sorry, Chris, two sets, and I often use them a metaphor of a bus, where the healthy adult's driving a bus, and where else are all the different players? Where are the parental modes?
Well, sometimes the critic, of course, wants to drive.
Yeah, that's right. It wants to drive, and then out comes the child modes that might drive for a bit, then come out the coping modes that drive.
How many chairs do you have? Do you have like a whole bus in your room?
Oh my gosh, I don't know if you can see, but my office is teeny. From a training, you would have seen some, not role play, one of my clients has agreed to use some video. I've got a teeny office, but we still manage to like line up these chairs or get them spaced out. I use small fold-up chairs. It works.
Very pragmatic.
But
what other things in terms of differences, what other differences do you think? I guess I'm thinking of, like, you know, a lot of our listeners would be aware of doing mode work and chairs and things like that. Is there anything specific augmentations from this sort of work that you think
I'm aware we're almost at an hour. So, look, I've got two that I'll mention, which are probably the most key standout. We're good, sweet. Probably the first is just simply, that I don't want to forget, we get clients to stand behind the chair when they're doing the voice. Yeah. So just like in regular chair work, you might interview that part. So we might interview the voice. But instead of when we're obviously interviewing the client's own inner critic mode or own coping mode or own vulnerable child, we'd have them sitting in the chair. when you're interviewing a voice, you would have them stand behind the chair because you don't want them to take ownership. It is not them. Their voice can say some horrendous things, very separate. The voice is very out of control. I know that a lot of people's own inner critics are fairly out of control as well, but this is also something that at next level the client has no control over and doesn't sound like them. So we have them stand behind. A lot, most of the time, I then, my eye contact is with the chair, not with the client when I'm interviewing it. And with the client's permission, I ask if the voice can step, not the client still in the driver's seat of that bus, but are they okay with the voice coming further forward in the bus so that they're present, so that the voice can hear me and the voice can answer and the client then translates. If I've got a client with DID, I talk a bit more with the client around whether they would prefer to stay in the driver's seat and for them to stand behind the chair and just translate for me what the voice is saying, or if they would feel safe with allowing the voice to actually come forward and take, like, be in the driver's seat. If that were to happen with my DID clients and a voice, the voice hearer has decided that's safe, they want that to happen, I ask that they stay sitting in the passenger seat of the bus so that they can stay have consciousness so that the client is still can hear what's happening between me and the voice. I still often have to relay some of it later, but the voice then will sit in the chair because I am talking directly to the voice, of course, through the client's body, I guess, but I am talking with in person with a new name, a new history, and then I can actually interview them. And I guess that brings me, do you have any questions around that? Because that brings me seamlessly into the next point.
Well, yeah. The question I have, you might be aware, one of my bugbear issues trying to sort out in the model is that I've, you know, not just myself, but colleagues also have come to the conclusion that it seems that these, particularly the critic modes, seem to have a sort of positive function at times or purport to have a function. I couldn't help but realize the way that you've been doing that as well at the workshop. I mean, can you say a few things about that?
Yeah, Rob, and that's so perfect because I would love to say that. And that actually is even a better streamline into my next point. So you are right. That is kind of the formulation that we have, is the idea that voices developed in ways to keep the client safe, often start stemming from childhood. A lot of our clients will even start voice hearing in childhood around the time of abuse. The voice may have at the earlier been kinder, maybe a little bit more to actually help the client psychologically get through their childhood. And then they may have changed in adolescent to help them cope with different scenarios, but often not. Often it will be just negative from the get-go. And sometimes it might come out later in life and be negative. But you are right. I kind of see this as the way it's negative, it often helps keep the client in their place. So, and what I mean by that is if you're in a household where you have to walk on eggshells or dad's going to get angry and that might end in physical abuse to you or to mom or your siblings, it's better to stay quiet, to do everything right, you know, to clean the house just so. To do all the things that make
it safer to beat yourself up than to be actually beaten up.
Yeah. So a voice that said that's either demanding, you must do this, you must do that, or even that's punitive and says, don't do that, you failed.
Who do you think you are?
And who do you think you are? Exactly. That still keeps the client in compliant surrender mode or avoidant modes where they're quiet, they're small, they're not heard. And therefore they're safe. And back in, this leads into this second. I'll finish your point.
Georgia, you have a lot of points.
This I have so cool. many points, Rob. Oh my God. So I do want to say, and this is something that with both, because I'm doing a lot of work with Chris Slee, and this work I'm actually doing with Dr. Caitlin Reddy-Huff, I do want to say, so she's also pioneering this with me at Perth Voices Clinic, and we're doing this with Chris Slee and still with Arnold Arntz. So in discussions with that group of four, we've talked a lot about this function stuff, and Arnold and Chris obviously having a lot more experience than Caitlin and I, we bring in the voices expertise, they're bringing in obviously the schema expertise, is that this idea that sometimes there may be a part of the inner critic that may have had some function originally, but really has zero function now, like really no longer.
No longer serves a good function, yeah.
Yeah, so most of the voices are almost like that, but you can still see the trail of where it was functional.
Mm-hmm.
We do have some voices that are really just... they will just describe horrendous sexual abuse to clients. They will describe how they should kill themselves in minute detail. Mm. There is nothing that's remotely kind or functional, or there's no part to it. And when we're doing chair work, that is definitely when we're pulling over the bus, keeping up with the bus metaphor, and kicking them off the bus or opening the door and taking the chair out of the therapy room.
Quite interested in looking at the longitudinal element of this, like, you know, seeing how, you know, that state, you know, as a teenager, I mean, obviously it's an impossibility at the moment, but seeing how, yeah, at one point it could have been a coping mode and then now you're 50 and you've had this and it's not really a coping mode now, but it was.
Yeah.
That's sort of, you know, sort of something.
But it sounds like it sort of tailors your approach a bit, Georgie. Like, you've got some flexibility there.
Yeah.
You will interview the mode. You will try to understand its function. You might even empathize with its function to some degree.
Yeah.
And, you know, but if it really is so toxic and it won't stop, you'll also sometimes go to the point of kicking it off the bus.
Definitely. And so my last point is, in terms of working with that function, I guess I just want to say how I do often do it. I was talking about interviewing the voice. I will often do this semi-early-ish into therapy. By the way, our intervention, again, we're fairly limited by funding. We're not doing schema in 10 sessions, but we are often doing it with about 30 sessions of our sleeve only. So I want to be clear, we're not talking really long-term in schema work, yet these clients are still getting, so far we've seen through kind of probably close to 15 clients now. Some nice outcomes so far. But some things that, one thing I want to say is, when we do interview the voice, and we might do this on multiple occasions with different voices, like I said, client stands behind, we'll interview the voice, we'll kind of ask them, when did you first develop? What was going on in the client's life at that time? Why did you feel that that was an appropriate way to talk to the client at that time? Amazingly, even clients that say the voice has no function, they're an, can I say asshole? Might just bleep that.
Sure, yeah.
Sure. No, the voice is an a-hole.
You said it, Georgie, already. That's okay.
I said it now. they really can't see any function. What's amazing is when we interview the voice, even with the client in the driver's seat, the voice actually can't identify, no, they really needed me. They needed to stay.
This is what I found with working even just with critics, you know, when you put them on a chair, they start telling you why they need to be there.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And then I kind of took something from a workshop I did by Scott Kellogg, which was to kind of get another chair. And I often separate, I'm pretty sure it was Scott Kellogg's omelet.
Thanks, Scott.
He might be listening to this going, no, it wasn't.
I never said that.
But this idea of, like, I separate out with the voice, the functional part of the voice that really was there to help the client stay safe, do their best in a difficult circumstance, and then the part that is now actually no longer needed, the part that really is now costing the client a huge deal because they're making the client feel paranoid, feel unsafe, not leave the house, or just feel useless and worthless, and therefore not be able to form new friendships, not be able to be intimate with people. And we start to negotiate with the voice that them to move further down the bus and to try and hold on to their function. The part that's not functional, that can be quite nasty, quite punitive, is taken off the bus, but we're working with what's left, the functional part of the
voice. Intention. It's okay to try to be safe. It's okay to not want to be rejected, although that makes sense.
Yeah, and it's really amazing how much actually doing this really direct work with the voice can change.
Yeah, right.
And these voices that clients I've done so many other work with, I've developed other type of approaches with improving relationships with voices, also through chair work, but not schema. But within using these more experiential techniques, including imagery scripting and the formulation, this work is so rich. We're getting real changes in voices and within the client's ability to stay in the healthy adult driving their bus. It's quite impressive.
So, Georgie, does anyone has anyone ever internalized your voice? Like, have you ever become the healthy adult?
Oh, my gosh, I have.
And they start hearing Georgie.
Yeah.
Like, instead of, like, the negative voice, now it's Georgie saying it's going to be okay, but it's in your voice. You ever had this?
I have, absolutely. Ooh. And especially when we were just doing imagery rescripting, so there was nothing else, and we weren't explicitly working on their own healthy adult, and I was entering these images. I had a lot of clients come in and be like, I heard your voice this week, and my instinct is to go, uh-oh. But then it would be this really lovely, and what's lovely is that sometimes clients will hear my voice for a very short amount of time, and then it's like as their own healthy adult is developed and fostered, my voice kind of retreats and they stop hearing me because they don't need me anymore. They've got their own healthy adult. They're able to do that work with their own vulnerable child and reassure it and be there for it and tell that inner critic, whether it's a voice or their own, that they don't need it and to go to the back of the bus. Yeah, it's great. It's great stuff.
So okay, look, we're getting on a bit, but we're very excited.
Yeah, we are now.
But there's two questions we just have to get through, and I'm just going to leave it to you, really. So The first question is, okay, you're in this space, you're doing the voices and everything. What do you make of delusions, you know, in this space and maybe co-occurring with voices? Where do you place something like delusional preoccupation in the model, if at all?
Yeah, look, I think I'd love to hear from you, Rob, more about it. I definitely have, you and I have talked about it more, but I'd love you to expand because it's actually more your area than mine. Even though I did work in psychosis for quite some time, like I said, we're a transdiagnostic clinic. More of our clients than not don't have psychosis. And those that do, the delusions, when I say they're stable, most of their delusions are pretty much wrapped up other than the paranoia. But the paranoia, which is still, so it may not be a full-fledged delusion. It's just more a suspicious, over-controlling.
Yeah, like a coping mode. Something bad's going to happen.
Yeah, it has a function. It keeps them safe. But I agree with you that you and I have had chats. So back to you, Rob, and tell us.
Oh, well, just really quickly. I'll quickly say clinical practice, but also with a little bit of master's research we did, we found a model in which delusional preoccupation seemed to be working as a form of coping, as a form of self-protection. So we've talked about that a little bit in Bali. I mean, what do you think about that idea?
Yeah, we do. We have clients that, for instance, sometimes they'll have quite a strong, quite a grandiose delusion that they're the epicenter of the world. And if they don't do such and such, the whole world will collapse. And it really often, some of these clients might have a history where they really were quite gifted and, you know, children, they were doing really well and expected big things of them. And yet they might have had psychosis quite young at like 17, 18, I guess not fulfilling what may have been their potential. And unfortunately, it feels like sometimes these delusions, it almost gives them that sense of importance and self-worth and self-esteem that had developed earlier. And it protects them from a deeper sense of a deep level of depression, and what would otherwise potentially be suicidality might progress to that point of people recognizing that they're not where they had hoped or even where.
So you're sympathetic to this idea that some of those, the delusional preoccupation could be a sort of delusional mode or preoccupation that to some degree keeps people from feeling vulnerable or alone.
And whether or not it needs to be another mode, but whether or not it's more just looking at what different types of modes already exist that get activated in those, I definitely do agree with you that they're working to protect the client against those more child modes.
That's for future research. And
discussions for sure.
The last question I think is very important as well is not all, of course, all the clients you see, but there would be a subset that might be having more the negative symptom profile or even full-blown, like even chronic schizophrenia and those kind of presentations. What do you think about the application or the promise of this sort of work for those type of populations? Where do you place negative symptoms? Can you work with more chronic sufferers?
Yeah, sure. So we have done some work with clients that have had longer-term schizophrenia with a lot more negative symptoms. And look, it's hard. Sometimes some clients who actually might not be quite so impaired by those negative symptoms, it is hard to know whether it's just a detached coping mode or is it more a negative symptom like a flat affect and yeah, detachment from a negative symptom perspective? It's hard to piece together and formulate. But what I do know is working with them using similar types of techniques like Rob, one that you've developed, like attunement, but also just doing chair work with that as a mode of detachment, I have had some really good luck on helping shift that, not completely, but enough that they can get back in touch with their kind of child modes, enough that you can then do the other chair work and to do the imagery rescripting. Because I must confess, it was a barrier when we're doing just imagery rescripting. The negative symptoms did sometimes, overwhelming detachment, again, unclear sometimes what.
So you can see why you'd ask the question, right? Because they're kind of very similar things, you know, with that flattened affect and stuff.
Yeah.
And is this a detached protector?
Exactly. And we know if people can't, like in imagery rescripting, if they can't connect to the feelings of fear and things, it's not going to work. We need to wrap up. I can see Chris being like,
okay, guys, there's a couple of thousand people maybe listening to this. And I think the tour de force of Georgie has been incredibly, interesting to listen to.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for coming on, Georgie.
Thanks, Rob.
Thanks for coming on. Like, you know, you're obviously so much energy and so much, you know, sort of new ideas and great implications to these clients that are very difficult to help, you know. And often a lot of the clinicians, we kind of go, oh, they put it in the too hard basket. And that's what I really can find from you. You go out looking for the too hard basket and seeing how to help these people that are really suffering. So it's really lovely to see.
I was really re-energized.
Is there anything you want to plug?
No, but just that I run a lot of workshops for both psychologists, mental health services, things like that, around voice hearing, working with voice hearers, both in schema and imagery, but also
your website.
Others. Yeah, website has more information, but if anyone would like to hit me up around that, that'd be great.
Just search for Perth Voices
what
Clinic.
What is the website address?
Yeah, just www.perthvoicesclinic.com.au. And there's lots of resources on there for clinicians and voice hearers, even if you're not in WA, like from clinical worksheets and things. So feel free to tap into that.
And is it worth, there's a few papers you mentioned. Should we link them up on the show notes, after the show?
Yeah, you're welcome to. I'll send you those in an email. Right?
We'll provide some resources and things. Thanks again, Georgie. It's been lovely having you on. And
so welcome.
I'm invigorating in the model. So thanks for having, and one thing we should actually say before you go is you're a listener of the pod. So you can go home next week and you'll be able to listen to yourself.
I think that'll be too uncomfortable, but
it's kind of weird. But
I'll look forward to the one after that.
Awesome, Georgie. You take care.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.